I guess everyone is as happy as I am that the end of the semester approaches. If there are questions, I can take questions, and otherwise I will continue with my description of the porous medium equation, which was all a little bit formal, and I guess everyone else will drift in as they drift in. So this formal description of the long-time asymptotics of the porous medium equation was the porous medium equation that I started to talk about on last week. And so I claimed that the long-time behavior of this equation could be understood by recognizing that this equation has a gradient flow structure on an infinite dimensional manifold of probability measures. And so there were sort of three claims. Claim one was that the what did we call this? This is the set of non-negative densities on Rn with total integral 1. And perhaps it's good to make sure to have finite second moments. And occasionally I may also want to center the mass of the measure at the origin. But the first claim was that this forms at least formally an infinite dimensional Riemannian manifold with the arc length distance being the Wasserstein distance between two probability measures U and V. And so I at least managed to sketch a proof of that last week. And the second claim, which I hope to describe today, is that this dynamics at least as long as M is bigger than 1 minus 2 over dimension plus 2, is the steepest descent or gradient flow of the entropy on this manifold here. And of course, what it means to be the steepest descent depends not only on the energy landscape that you're descending down, but also on the notion of distance, because you take a step in some direction and you check how much has your energy dropped, but you also have to check how far have I stepped. And it's the ratio of these two things which determines what's the steepest direction. And finally, so what it means to be steepest descent depends not only on the energy landscape, but also on the underlying metric. And I don't know what I mean. I mean both an energy and entropy. So this is a Lyapunov functional for the dynamics. If you take any solution to that equation up there, and you plug it in E of U of T and you differentiate with respect to T, it's not hard to check that this is going down. In some physical sense, this is the energy of a gas whose density is given by U. On the other hand, in the case M equals 1, I should write this here. So this is for M not equal to 1. And this is the Boltzmann entropy. And so sometimes it's also called an entropy. And in the sense that this Lyapunov functional is like an entropy, because in thermodynamics, the second law tells you that entropy always goes up, it never goes down. So this thing is called Boltzmann entropy, and this thing is sometimes called the Erdős-Rényi entropy when it comes up in a combinatorial context, in an information theoretic context. The third fact is that, we checked this last class, and we checked this probably the week before that, that actually this energy entropy thing here is geodesically convex on this manifold. At least if this was my inequality. If M is bigger than 1 minus 1 over the dimension, and we did a little computation in finite dimensions, at least, that suggests that when you're doing steepest descent in a convex landscape, everything is being driven towards the minimum of the entropy. And in fact, if I take two different positions on the landscape and I flow for some short time, the trajectories are going to take me closer together than they were initially. And so actually, it's a consequence of this. That if I have two solutions, U1 and U2, to this equation, the Wasserstein distance can only go down. So the flow is acting as a contraction. So in the argument that I gave last week, this was the missing ingredient in order to say that under this evolution, the distribution is getting spread more and more thin over Rn. If I rescale space such that the average, the variance of that thing is converging to a constant, then the Wasserstein distance between the two rescaled solutions will go down like some constant over a constant plus t to a power, where the power is related to m. So there's a bunch of constants. We sketched an argument for this as long as this holds, where these are now the rescaled distributions. And I'm actually going to do better than this a little bit later, in the sense that I'm going to make these constants explicit, so you don't need to worry about that too much. I should maybe check that I've written down the right value of alpha, which I'm prone to perhaps not do. Yeah, no, I seem to have gotten it right. Okay. So I want to clarify this one here. for that, I should remind you a little bit about the manifold structure. Which can actually be made rigorous in the case where I'm a compact subdomain of Rn and where u is bounded away from 0 and infinity. So if I have a path of such densities, u of t, then I said the prescription for the tangent space was isomorphic to what I call W12 of U0 of Rn, which was the closure of the compactly supported smooth functions with respect to a norm. And the norm comes from the inner product and if on the other hand I represented this curve by a density u of tx with respect to Lebesgue, then the relationship between this density and one of these tangent vectors was given by solving this this differential equation. I'll call this u naught, I guess, grad phi. And that was a linear transformation from this partial u with respect to t to psi. So are there questions about that procedure? And so now I want to argue that this, so basically what I'm doing here is I'm defining the length of a tangent vector associated with such a curve. I differentiate the curve with respect to time. I solve this elliptic problem, divergence of u naught grad psi to find psi. I compute the norm squared of psi using this inner product, and that tells me what the length of this tangent vector is. So if I take such a curve and I ask how quickly is an energy like this decreasing along it, So the lemma is that du dt equals divergence of u gradient partial derivative, variational derivative of e with respect to u represents steepest descent of and somehow the proof of this is just really Cauchy-Schwarz. So I should take some such path, u of t x, and I should compute the derivative of the energy with respect to it. And as long as the energy is given by some integral expression like this, then I get a variational derivative with e of e with respect to u times the change of u with respect to t. And but in order to know how, okay, so this tells me how quickly is the energy changing with respect to t, I also need to know how quickly is the curve parameterized with respect to t? So I need to, that involves the length of this tangent vector somehow. So let me rewrite this quantity in terms of the tangent vector psi. I should have said if I was in a compact domain, the boundary conditions for this equation are no flux at the boundary. So gradient psi dot n omega equals 0. The velocity should be parallel to the boundary. So this is like a velocity in a continuity equation. And so I can do an integration by parts. There's no contribution from the boundary term because of this boundary condition. And I would, so I guess this is actually an integral over omega. And I get something like this. And Cauchy-Schwarz tells me that the smallest this can be is, the norm of this function with respect to this inner product times the norm of that function with respect to the same inner product. So this is evaluated t equals 0. With a minus sign. And equality holds in Cauchy-Schwarz. If and only if this function is a scalar multiple of that function. So essentially this plus an irrelevant constant. This is irrelevant because I only take these norms don't see additive constants because of the gradient in here. So this Hilbert space is actually a Hilbert space in which the constants are quotient to doubt. But this constant is relevant. And since I did actually the lower bound, I guess that this variational derivative should be equal to minus a positive constant times psi in order to get this. And so this is equal to in case of equality. And on the other hand, if I compare this with a gradient with an abstract gradient flow, and if I differentiate that with respect to v of xt with respect to time, then I would get gradient v of x dot, which is maybe gradient v is minus x dot, so this would be minus x dot of t squared. And so if I want this, since this is the norm squared of the tangent vector, if I want this to be an abstract gradient flow, the constant needs to be 1 here. And so, in other words, picking this to maximize the change of energy for a given length of tangent vector means that I need to make the tangent vector parallel to this particular derivative of the energy. And if I, in addition, want the rate of decrease to be proportional to the steepness of the slope, then I need the constant to be 1. And so, therefore, steepest descent with rate
proportional to whatever this is, slopes. It's the gradient. It's also gradient squared of b to slope squared implies direction. Phi should equal minus 1 over c edu with c equals 1. And so if I go back to this this equation for the tangent vector and I plug this in, then I get that equation at the top. Somehow that's the abstract calculation that goes into this thing at the top. I happened to do it at time zero, but I could equally well have done it at some time t naught. And in these particular examples, for this guy, how do I compute something like this? Well, I look at E of u naught plus lambda delta u, and I differentiate that with respect to lambda and set lambda equal to 0. So this is like 1 over m minus 1 of integral u of x plus lambda delta u of x to the m. And when I take a lambda derivative of an expression like this, assuming I can bring the differentiation inside the integral, I get something like this. When I set setting lambda equals 0, I get something like that. And whatever multiplies this is what we call this guy. So for this particular choice of energy, the variational derivative is m over m minus 1 u naught, or u to the m minus 1. And if I plug that into this equation, well, it's gradient. The gradient of this thing, the m minus 1 comes down, and so I get m u to the m minus 2 of x gradient u. If I multiply that by u, I get an m minus 1. And that happens to be the gradient of u to the mth power. And so for this particular choice of entropy, the equation governing the steepest descent is du dt equals divergence of gradient of u to the mth power. For this particular choice of entropy, if you go through the same calculation, you will get the variational derivative of E with respect to U is probably log U plus 1. If I take a gradient of this and then multiply by U, I get the gradient of U, and so I would get U to the 1th power here. So that's how I recover the heat equation. Max.
So on the board, on the break board, so there is no well-defined meaning. So the definition of gradient flow is rather formal, or?
Yes.
So it's not a rigorous definition, or? Or you can define it to be that.
Okay, so on a length space, what I should do is, hopefully my my E is differentiable along geodesics. So I should look at every geodesic leading away from the point where I'm standing. I should compute the rate of decrease of E with respect to arc length. And hopefully one of those geodesics maximizes the rate of decrease of E with respect to arc length. And so if that's true, or if there's then that's the direction of maximum decrease. There might a priori be more than one of them. And that's half of the definition of gradient flow. That tells you what direction you should be going. And the other half is encoded in this statement here, which says that the rate of change of your height should be proportional to the slope squared. Yes. So even once you've chosen a direction of steepest decrease, there's still a question of how fast you should walk along it. And this is the condition here. And that's what fixes C to be 1. Differentiability of E. Uh-huh. Yep. And what we know is that what we actually know about E is that it's convex along geodesics. And so there's no question that one-sided derivatives of E exist with respect to arc length along geodesics. What might be what's slightly less obvious is there a unique solution that produces equality here? And I think that's fine as long as we're in this kind of situation up there where U is bounded away from zero and infinity, then things are great. If U were to vanish on part of the domain, then that would cause problems because psi would not be uniquely determined on those parts of the domain. And it gets a lot uglier. In principle, you don't care what the velocity is where U not vanishes. Because which direction U is moving should be determined just by the velocity where it's non-vanishing. But you get into a lot of problems trying to make those arguments rigorous if you don't make some regularizing hypotheses like that. Other questions? Okay. So... Right. So I only wanted to say, what do I mean by variational? So the variational derivative of this with respect to U is m over m minus 1 U to the m minus 1. So then I want to plug this into this formula up here to see what the evolution equation is. So I want to take a gradient of that and multiply by U. And so I took another gradient, and I multiplied by U, and I found out that what I get in the end is gradient of U to the M. And that's where this equation comes from. Other questions? Okay. Oh, yeah, and so I made this remark briefly, but I think it's worth fleshing out that... that there's a physical relationship between this this energy or entropy and this pressure up here. I'll call it an energy, just to confuse you. So if I have a gas in a box of volume V guess of mass m. Box of volume V, and so the density therefore is M over V, and I ask how much work does it cost me to crush, if this is a very large box with volume essentially infinite, and I want to crush it down to some finite volume V naught, and I ask what the amount of work done. Against a pressure given by some function P of rho, then I'm asked to compute an integral like this, integral from infinity to V naught of P of rho dV, and so I imagine, for example, rho to the nth power as my pressure. So then I would have but the density is the mass over the volume. And so this is a certain number of powers of the fixed mass of the gas times the integral of V to the minus M, which is something like V to the 1 minus M over 1 minus M, evaluated at infinity and V naught. And at least in the case where M is bigger than 1, then at infinity this vanishes. And so I actually prefer to write this in the form M over V naught to the nth power V naught to over 1 minus M. So this now looks like rho to the M V naught over 1 minus M. And so somehow where this functional comes from is by dividing space up into small boxes and treating the internal energy. So this is the work. This is an internal energy of the gas in each box as being the density of the gas in that box to the nth power times the volume of that box divided by 1 minus m. And so somehow that's where this 1 minus m comes from. And that's, this is like... this is like rho to the m dV, right? So there's some sense in which this choosing this Lyapunov function is physically natural, and there's some sense in which it's mathematically natural, which is that it's also it's the correct energy landscape for this particular metric. Some of these equations can also be written as gradient flows of different energies with respect to other metrics. For example, in the case of the heat equation, when m equals 1, what we've just checked is that the heat equation is actually gradient flow of the Boltzmann entropy with respect to the Wasserstein distance. It's also a well-known fact that the heat equation is gradient flow of the Dirichlet energy, integral of gradient u squared, with respect to the L2 metric. And so in a certain sense, it's up to you which gradient flow structure you prefer. So I can change the energy if I also change the metric. Yeah, so this is a typical, this is something that depends on the composition of the gas, so. No, not always. I could have done this calculation with a more general P. So let me tell you something a little bit about real gases. So So of course the ideal gas has P of rho equals rho, equal constant rho. And that comes from whatever it is, PV equals NRT. So the N over B gives you the rho. At a fixed temperature. On the other hand, you can do a quantum mechanical calculation that tells you if I put a collection of electrons into a box of volume V, and I neglect the electrostatic repulsion, so let's say uncharged electrons, there's still a pressure on the walls of this box because of the Pauli principle. If you try to crush a lot of electrons into a small box, another way to say it is the uncertainty principle tells you the velocities have to get quite large, and the velocities of the electrons bumping against the walls of the box create a pressure. And you can calculate this pressure, you can calculate the internal energy of such a gas roughly by finding the first n eigenvalues of the Dirichlet-Laplacian on this box and adding them up. This is somehow, in the independent particle model, this is what quantum mechanics tells you the energy should be. And if you do that and you think of it as a function of the number of electrons divided by the volume of the box, you get an expression exactly of this form, plus lower order corrections. And so the pressure, starting from the Schrodinger equation, you get in, say, three dimensions. You get something like rho to the 5/3. But of course, the Schrodinger equation is not the end of the story, because this is an equation for non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and basically this equation starts from a relationship like energy equals 1/2 mv squared, so p squared over 2m. The Schrodinger equation starts from something like that. The correct energy is something more like I probably get it wrong. So all constants are one. So it's a bit more like this. So this would be relativistic. And this sort of says, yeah, at low momentum, the energy looks like that. But I set all constants to one again. But at large momentum, this grows in different ways. This looks like p squared over 2 as p goes to 0, and it looks like absolute p as p goes to infinity. And so if I redo this calculation with a quantum mechanical model, then I get a pressure that looks it looks like some constant times rho to the 5/3 as rho tends to 0, and some constant times rho to the 4/3 as rho tends to infinity, which was probably found by Chandrasekhar. And so this is a typical example that isn't a power law. And that's roughly because E is not a homogeneous function of the momentum, because there's a rest mass energy plus a kinetic energy in relativistic mechanics. So somehow choosing P to the M is just, or U to the M in these equations is a simplifying assumption, and one can also look at equations like this for more general P and more general A. But the relationship between A and P is still given by this procedure of integrating P of rho dV. Other questions? So yeah, so what's famous about this is so Chandrasekhar did a study in the 30s of whether this degeneracy, this quantum mechanical degeneracy pressure of electrons, is strong enough to prevent a gravitating gas from wanting to collapse under the Newtonian theory. So, of course, the Newtonian gravitational potential energy becomes large and negative if you pack the gas into a small box. But this internal energy that comes from this pressure becomes large and positive, and the question is which one wins. And the answer is, if the gas is non-relativistic, then the pressure prevents it from collapsing.
But this pressure doesn't grow as quickly at large densities as that one does. And it's a miracle which I don't understand that 4/3 is exactly critical. If this pressure were any smaller than 4/3, then gravity would overwhelm the quantum mechanical pressure of the electrons and the star would collapse. Because this exponent is exactly 4/3, you're in a critical case of some sublevel inequalities that tell you if the total mass of rho is not too large, then the pressure can control the gravitational energy. If the mass is larger, then the gravitational energy can overwhelm this. So in other words, it's no longer a question of which thing is growing like a higher exponent. They're growing like the same exponent. Now it matters what the constants in front are. And the mass of the gas determines the constant in front. So, okay, that's cultural history. It doesn't have anything to do with optimal transportation as far as I know. Great. So, right. Okay, so now let me do a better job with this rate calculation. So, solution U of Tx is spreading at a rate like we computed it the other day. I think it was this. And so I want to define a V of tau and y such that u at some very large x value is related to v at x over 1 plus alpha t to the 1 over alpha. And of course, I want, if this is has integral 1, I'd like this to have integral 1. So I also better multiply this by 1 plus alpha t to the 1 over alpha outside, n over alpha, where n is dimension, so that v has the same mass as u. And I could put t here, but it's actually convenient to rescale. Since I got an algebraic decay rate here, I would like to convert this algebraic decay rate into an exponential decay rate. So let me rescale by, let me put a logarithm here. And so if you do this, alpha is the same as before, then you find that du dt equals Laplacian um is equivalent to dv d tau equals Laplacian, this is now with respect to y, of v to the m plus an extra term, and the extra term looks like divergence of y v, I guess. And so, of course, this V is the same shape as this U, and the only difference is that as this U spreads thinner and thinner and tends to zero, this V is going to tend to some characteristic shape, which is the same shape that the U hat would tend to, that we defined last class. And so V satisfies this nice differential equation. In fact, this differential equation is of the form divergence with respect to V of, or with respect to Y, rather, of V of y tau, gradient with respect to y, a variational derivative of f with respect to v, where B is, S is the same as before, plus an extra term, which is basically the variance of Y. Right? So, so by S by B equals DE dB plus 1/2 Y squared. So M over M minus 1 D to the M minus 1, it's gone by now, plus 1/2 Y squared. So you plug this into this equation, you check that you get the same thing you had before. So even this rescaled evolution has a gradient flow structure with respect to the Wasserstein distance. Also a W2 gradient flow. And so I can ask, is it still true that F is geodesically convex on this manifold of probability measures? And I know that this term is geodesically convex, and so I can ask about the geodesic convexity of this term. And I claim this term is actually uniformly geodesically convex, i.e., the Hessian at V of F, not only is it bigger than 0, but it's actually bigger than 1. And if I put a capital lambda here, I would get a capital lambda here. So remember we had this little lemma last class that if x dot is equal to minus gradient v of xt and v2v is bigger than lambda at all x, then x1 of t, x2 of t is less than e to the minus capital lambda t x1 of 0, x2 of 0. Well, I derived this in Euclidean space, but if one knew a little Riemannian geometry, you would get the same thing on a Riemannian manifold, except with the arc length distance between the two solutions being controlled by the initial arc length distance between them. And since this thing has the structure, the formal structure of an infinite dimensional Riemannian manifold, you should expect this estimate here gives you the same kind of contraction rate. And so let me just check the uniform geodesic convexity of this term. It's not very hard. So they were given by some convex function, gradient phi pushing u naught forward to u1, and they satisfy that us of 1 minus sx plus t
grad phi of x equals u naught of x. And then there should be a determinant of a Hessian somewhere. Right, so they satisfied this because us was given by 1 minus s identity plus s gradient phi push forward u naught. And actually, I just need this formula. I don't really need the Mongeau-Pair thing at all. So if I want to calculate a term like this, therefore, lambda over 2 integral of y squared us of y dny is equal to lambda over 2 integral of 1 minus s x plus grad phi plus s grad phi of x squared u naught of x. And so if I take two derivatives of this with respect to s and set s equals 0, I will get lambda over, well, the 2 will go away, so I will get lambda. The quadratic term in S is gradient phi of x minus x. And so I will get gradient phi of x minus x squared, naught of x, dnx. And this is nothing but the Wasserstein distance between u naught and u1, because this gradient of a convex function is the optimal thing pairing u naught to u1. And the Wasserstein distance squared. And so, of course, the s here is not quite arc length. It's arc length rescaled by the Wasserstein distance squared. And so and I guess that actually this computation works even if I'm not at s equals 0. So I should really give this a name. So let me call this variance of US, lambda variance of US. And so this thing here is like arc length squared. And so this is this estimate that we wanted. And so actually, it's not just an estimate, it's an equality. So this is, in other words, this variance is a very special function. A bit like a parabola on Rn in the sense that its Hessian is constant everywhere. And so this rescale dynamics, the V instead of the U, satisfies this equation, which has this much stronger contraction property. And so at least by analogy, we should conclude that the Wasserstein distance between any two solutions, V1 and V2 of this equation, which correspond to solutions U1 and U2 of that equation, satisfy lambda was actually 1 in our case.
And so this tells us a rate, this tells us an exponential rate of contraction for this rescaled evolution d. And you might say, well, okay, it's nice to see that this equation is contracting in such a strong sense, but on the other hand, Wasserstein distance is a very weak metric, and so this convergence to some characteristic shape is happening in a very weak sense. And what can you say about stronger metrics? And I guess one of the things that I will still do after the break, so let's take a 5-minute break. And the presence of this very strong kind of uniform convexity in the problem actually tells me that many different notions of convergence become equivalent. And so we'll talk about some log sub 11 inequalities and transportation inequalities and so on that turn this convergence in a weak metric like Wasserstein distance into a convergence like a strong metric, into convergence in a strong metric like, I don't know, L1 or L2. Well, I'm lying slightly, but yeah, okay. So let's take a 5-minute break and then I'll continue.
By means of this rescaling between the other function also has gradient slope, so that's why essentially you're estimating the rate of rescaling, right?
Yeah.
And this what gives you this estimate. So you kind of, you just assume that this is just contracting, but you don't care about this rate of contraction of the V function, but just because of this extra.
Yeah. Right. So this extra term makes the contraction, so this is a weak contraction in the sense the distance doesn't expand in this case.
What?
The distance between two solutions never expands. But it's hard, so the argument that I used last class, it allows you to get the dependence on T correct, but it doesn't do a very good job with the constants. It throws away all kinds of information about the constants.
It's not a uniform contraction
in any sense. No, it's not uniform in any sense.
There is no unit, say unit ball cannot be put into any other ball during some estimated time.
Right, so there's a good reason why it can't be a uniform contraction in any sense.
Just because it can have a viable function?
No, because it preserves center of mass.
And so on.
So if you take suppose you take the heat equation, and your two solutions are the heat kernel, and heat kernel translated by some distance d. Those two solutions stay at constant distance to each other for all time.
Right, so that they all contract to just zero solution.
Well, okay, they contract to the zero solution, but they also become more and more Gaussianly shaped as they're contracting. Well, these don't because they're already Gaussian, but.
Yes, but the
W metric also doesn't see the zero solution because it only applies to probability measures.
True.
And so the argument is I start out with some initial junk.
It applies to probability measures, but you can have a zero probability measure, can't you?
No, probability measures are measures with integral one. I have this constraint that the integral be
one.
So the argument is the following. I start out with junk like this. I wait a long time. I will see junk like this with a characteristic radius of square, in the heat equation case, of square root of t. So let me rescale this by square root of t. Then I see junk like this with a characteristic radius of 1. And the claim is that if t goes to infinity, this junk converges to a normal Gaussian.
And this is this claim.
And then this is quantifying the rate at which this convergence to a normal Gaussian happens.
So, okay, so this is the scaling procedure.
Yes.
And now, in terms of t, you already see that the shape of v stabilizes somehow, right?
Yes, because no matter whatever two things I start with here, after a long time, they're close together. This factor is going to zero. And in the heat equation, these things would all be converging to Gaussians. These things would all be converging to standard normal Gaussian, actually.
In the heat, you mean even M equals
1. M equals 1 here. So M equals 1 here.
But it's just kind of
Gaussian other way? So.
Yeah, it's, in fact, I will say exactly what it is. It's a Baron-Blatt solution. And it looks like it looks qualitatively like this if m is bigger than 1, and like this with algebraic instead of exponential tails if m is less than 1.
You have this construction of this, right? And whenever you like to put inertia, you will be moving kind of in those directions, along the directions of volume preserve.
Whenever you put a what?
Some inertia.
Inertia. Mm-hmm.
Then, so in some sense, all these equations do not kind of count in inertia, right?
Right, absolutely.
So, and then the Euler, would, on the contrary, would be along this.
Yes.
So inertia somehow is here, and here you'll see on the, how they move mass. Right? So
yes. In fact,
it's kind of strange that, I mean, there are two separate pictures here and there, but as far as the joint pictures concerned, we see only Bürger.
Right. I wonder if actually if the correct joint picture might, I mean, if some aspects of the joint picture mightn't be captured in kinetic theory. So for example, Boltzmann, yeah. This might be some convolution in V or something, and so in a certain sense, the advection term is more like Euler, and this term is more like, it's a bit more like the heat equation. It's a bit more like these gradient flows. In fact, one place where these things come up is if you take f of x and v and t to be independent of space at time zero. Then they're independent of space at all time, and the advection term disappears, and you have something more like this. I mean, there's this Boltzmann entropy that goes down along the flow, and the equilibrium shapes are Gaussians with respect to the variable V. And then if you start something with non-homogeneous, so if you had an x-dependent initial data, then it's much more complicated. Well, this is not divergence free, but it's something else. It's a constant, zero acceleration at least. I'm a low-tech guy. So maybe I resume. Other questions? Okay. So one of the things that I can point out is that for any two initial data here, if you wait long enough, this factor gets small. And so it says that arbitrary initial data are converging to the same. As t goes to infinity, these things have to be converging to the same thing. And so what is the long time limit of this evolution here? Well, since f is going down, and in fact f is going down as quickly as possible, since it's a gradient flow of f with respect to the Botstein distance, you might expect that you're converging to the minimum of f. and that universal shape should minimize F of U on M. And so the picture is that you're in now a uniformly convex potential, and there's some minimizing shape here, and no matter where you start, you converge towards this minimizing shape as t goes to infinity. And of course, if I'm to minimize f of u on m, then I should satisfy some kind of Euler-Lagrange equation. And if M was a vector space, the Euler-Lagrange equation would be variational derivative of F with respect to U equals 0. But M is not a vector space because of the positivity constraint. And, and also there's this other constraint on the mass. So the constraint on the mass says that actually the variational derivative of F with respect to U should be equal to a constant, and that constant is a Lagrange multiplier for this constraint here. And the fact that if I look at perturbations U naught plus lambda delta U, delta U can have both signs where U naught is positive, but it can only have one sign where U naught is zero. And that tells me that I have an equality . This is equal to some constant, I should give it a name, mu, where u of x is bigger than 0. And for constrained minimization. And it has to satisfy an inequality where u is equal to 0, and the inequality is actually this one. Because even where u is 0, I can add mass, but I can't subtract it and still respect this constraint. And on the other hand, the variational derivative of f with respect to u, we computed a moment ago, this is equal to u to the m minus 1th power over m minus 1. And if we had a term like this, then the variational derivative of this with respect to v is lambda y squared over 2. I will set lambda equal to 1. And so I have an equation like this fellow here. And so I can subtract mu from both sides. I get something is bothering me about this. I'd rather want to write it this way. This is equal to mu minus x squared over 2 and bigger than or equal to mu minus x squared over 2, where u is equal to 0. And so that says where this is negative here. And since u is non-negative, this is positive here. And so I can also, if using the notation that lambda plus is equal to maximum of lambda and 0 whenever lambda is real, I can write both of these conditions as mu to the m minus 1 of x equals the positive part of mu minus x squared over 2. And so, there should have been an m here.
So I'm multiplying through by m minus 1 over m and taking the m minus 1th root. I get a slightly different constant. And so this is actually the shape of the thing which all these solutions converge to, where mu tilde chosen to ensure, that's the Lagrange multiplier conjugate constraint of conserved mass, integral of u over Rn equals 1. This is called a Barenblatt profile. Mu tilde is bigger than 0. And in case m is bigger than 1, this looks like an upside-down parabola cut off at some distance and then raised to some power. And when m is less than 1, so this is the case m bigger than 1, when m is less than 1, it's more customary to write this in this form. I haven't changed anything. But now I have a positive denominator, so I don't need to worry about this plus sign. I have a negative numerator, which I bring downstairs by doing this, and now the exponent is positive. And so this are these long-tailed, this is the long-tailed fast diffusion profile. And in between them, in the case that m is equal to 1, you would have to redo the calculation to get it right. But you would get that, so this is u infinity, it's the minimizer. U infinity of x is e to the minus 1 half x squared plus mu tilde. And the mu tilde contains this information here in it, the 2 pi n over 2 that normalizes this standard normal Gaussian. So this is the minimizer for this energy on this manifold, and it's the shape, the characteristic shape towards which all solutions converge. And so we have a rate of convergence in this kind of weak norm, W infinity, and I would like to discuss rates of convergence in stronger norms. And so I would like to come back to this picture. And observe, so u of infinity sitting down here, Hessian of E is, or let's call it F even, Hessian of F is bigger than lambda, capital lambda. There are, of course, three ways that I can measure convergence to u infinity of some ut. I can measure sort of the horizontal distance, which in our case is like the Wasserstein distance. Another way of measuring how close I am to the bottom of this uniformly convex potential is I can measure the vertical distance, which is like, it's this sometimes called the relative entropy. And I also expect that this will go to zero as t goes to infinity, and I can ask how fast. And another thing that I can do is I can ask what is the slope of the tangent plane at this point, and I can expect that slope is going to go to zero as t goes to infinity, and I can ask how fast. So the slope and that's the slope computed in the Wasserstein metric. And in these applications, this thing is called the relative entropy, and this thing here is called the information. Because in the case m equals 1, this is the, what do you call it, the Shannon-Stam-Boltzmann entropy, and this thing turns out to be what's called the Fisher information. But what I would like to argue is that if I'm in a uniformly convex potential, all these things are related to each other by some implications. And so here's a freshman calculus lemma. Suppose I have a C2 function on the line, and f double prime is bigger than lambda, bigger than 0. And I guess I should call it capital lambda. And f of s is always non-negative with equality if and only if s equals 0. Then I claim that the difference between f and 0, which this is 0, by the way, is always bounded. The uniform convexity tells me that that's bounded below my lambda f squared over 2. And it also tells me that this is bounded above by the gradient of f prime squared. Divided by 2 lambda. And so there are other relationships, and also so there's an HWI inequality, which I'm a little nervous to write down without notes. So also f of s is less than s f prime of s minus lambda s squared over 2. And so what does this say? This says, if I know that the slope is decaying to 0, then I know that the relative entropy is decaying to 0. And if I know that the relative entropy is decaying to 0, then I know that the Wasserstein distance is decaying to 0. So somehow, rate of convergence in slope is stronger than rate of convergence in height, which in turn is stronger than rate of convergence in horizontal distance for a uniformly convex function. But on the other hand, if I know that s is going to 0, and I can bound the slope, then I also know that this is again relative entropy. So I can convert information rate of convergence Wasserstein distance into rate of convergence in relative entropy. I don't know how to convert it into rate of convergence in information, but there are these various relationships, and this is some freshman calculus theorem. But what you enroll all of these definitions in the context of these functionals here, then you get, this one turns into, I guess, the log sub lev inequality. This one turns into Talligrand's transportation inequality. And this one's a relatively recent inequality called HWI by Felix Otto and Cedric Villani, who discovered it. Yes, Max. HWI. H is it's the Boltzmann H theorem, so H is entropy. I is information. And W is Wasserstein distance. So they think of this as an inequality. Of course, they don't write it. So I've written this baby lemma in freshman calculus. They don't write it in this form, but they write it in terms of which will derive what it means in terms of the actual objects on this infinite dimensional manifold. But they think of it as saying that the entropy is controlled by the Wasserstein distance and the information. So there are actually three inequalities here. I sketched the proof of two of them. I leave you to do the third one for homework. They're all easy. So the proof of one is that I let G of S be, F of S minus lambda S squared over 2. I want to show this thing, by the way. This thing is equal to 0 if S equals 0. And I want to show that it's bigger than 0 always. And so I compute derivatives. Now this is strictly larger than 0 because of my bound on the Hessian of F. And so this is a strictly convex function. And its derivative vanishes. So 0 is a critical point. The only kind of critical point that a strictly convex function can have is a global minimum, hence a global minimum. And the proof of the second one is slightly more interesting, and it's more similar to the proof of the third one. It's a similar kind of thing, though. I let G of S be F prime of S squared over 2 lambda minus F of S. This thing, again, equals 0 at S equals 0. And I want to show that this is a global minimum. Because S is the minimum for the convex function F, and so the derivative of F vanishes at 0. And the derivative of G is F prime of S times F double prime of S over lambda minus F prime of S. So that's, let me just put some brackets in here. So this factor in here never vanishes, and so this vanishes if and only if F is 0, because that's the unique minimum of the convex function F. So G has no critical points other than 0, and on the other hand, if you compute one more derivative, you find that and if I evaluate this derivative at 0, I get something positive, because this is positive and this is positive. So this unique critical point is a local minimum, and so it's increasing to either side of 0, and it has to keep increasing everywhere, because otherwise it would have another critical point somewhere else. So local min at 0, strict local min, because this is strictly positive, implies global min, since no other critical points. And so somehow from this freshman calculus lemma, you derive immediately so if if E was a function on Rn, and E was bounded below by lambda, then I derive immediately that and let's let x infinity be the minimizer, and there can only be one because of this strict convexity. Then I get this immediately by applying it to f of s equals e of 1 minus fx plus fx infinity, something like this. Apply lemma to this. And I also get the HWI inequality, which says that the relative entropy is less than the x minus x infinity dotted with gradient of E of x minus lambda x minus x infinity squared over 2. Right. Great. So yeah, so these are the things that follow immediately for a function on Rn. If I replace this by some Riemannian manifold, I get the same thing except this is a distance. And similarly, this is a distance. And if I don't like keeping the inner product around on this Riemannian manifold, I can estimate this by the distance between. So this would be a tangent vector on the Riemannian manifold, and so I can estimate this by the distance between x and x infinity times the norm of the gradient of E at x. So this is the HWI inequality of Otto and Villani. And so let's work some of these inequalities out in the special case. I guess the Boltzmann entropy, where you have this, this is the minimizer U infinity. Special case. And this is the minimizer. So suppose I want to write down this inequality here, number 2, the one that I claim is the log sub 11 inequality. It says that f of u minus f of u infinity is supposed to be less than the gradient in Wasserstein distance sense of f at u squared over 2 lambda, but lambda was equal to 1, so just over 2. And it's customary to write any arbitrary u in the manifold M can be written as a multiple of U infinity, a non-negative multiple of U infinity. So let me call this multiplying factor F of x squared. So the relative entropy here looks like integral of f squared u infinity log u log f squared u infinity minus integral u infinity plus 1/2 integral x squared u infinity minus 1/2 x squared u infinity. And so I'm going to work that out first. I'm helped by the fact that u infinity has this special form. So log of u infinity is equal to minus x squared over 2 minus a constant. And so so this log of u infinity becomes, I guess, okay, it becomes minus x squared over 2 minus this horrible constant. And already this term cancels this term. And this first term, I want to break the log up into two pieces. So, of course, I have integral of f squared u infinity log f squared. That's the piece I'm going to keep. And I also have plus integral f squared u infinity log of u infinity, which is like minus x squared over 2 minus this constant again. And this term here is going to cancel that term there. So there's a plus 1/2 integral x squared f squared u infinity that cancels. And this term here is going to cancel this term, because when I pull the constants out, I have a positive sign here, I have a negative sign here, I have integral u infinity, which is 1 here, I have integral f squared u infinity, which is also 1. And so so this term goes away with that term from there. And so I'm left with f squared u infinity log f squared on the left-hand side. I want to evaluate the right-hand side of this inequality. Compute the gradient of f with respect to Wasserstein distance squared at some function u. And so remember, the tangent vector associated to f was df, variational derivative of f in w1 2u. And so I should just use the inner product on this Hilbert space for this tangent vector. And that tells me, so this is inner product of dfu, dfu in this funny weighted Hilbert space, which is integral over Rn u of x, gradient of variational derivative of f with respect to u squared. And the variational derivative of that f with respect to u is log u plus 1 plus 1/2 x squared. So the gradient of this
is gradient of u over u plus x. So on the other hand, I want to represent u as f squared times u infinity, and so actually from here this is log of f squared x u infinity x plus 1/2 x squared, and that's log of f squared of x. There was a constant one that I don't care much about. The log of u infinity is minus 1/2 x squared minus log of 2 pi to the n over 2 plus 1 plus 1/2 x squared. So a nice thing cancels out. These x squareds go away. And when I take the gradient of this, I get the gradient of the constants go away, and so I get gradient of log of f squared of x, which is, I don't know, what is it, f squared of x times 2 of f of x gradient f of x. And so 1 power of f cancels out. That's great. When I plug that into this, I get integral Rn of f squared of x, u infinity of x, 2 gradient f of x over f of x dnx. This f cancels that f squared, and I get 4 and everything is great, except I'm missing a factor of 2, which surprises me a little bit. Right, there was a factor of 2 in the original inequality. So this thing here is less than 1/2 of that thing. So I cancel the constants, and if I liked, I could even bring this 2 down and cancel this factor of 2. And so this is an inequality which holds provided f satisfies this constraint here. And you're supposed to think about this as being analogous to, so why is this called the log sub lev inequality? If I don't have that Gaussian weight there, the standard, I don't know, Poincaré inequality or whatever, the standard sub lev inequality says something more like integral of Rn of the L2 norm of f is controlled by some dimension dependent constant times the integral of gradient f squared. And this constant goes to hell as n goes to infinity. So I guess that Cn goes to infinity as n goes to infinity for so this thing that we've just written down under this extra hypothesis, integral f squared u infinity equals 1, implies integral of f squared of x u infinity is less than integral gradient f squared log f u infinity is like this, except there's no constant here. And so this works. This is a good inequality from the point of view of taking the infinite dimensional limit, because it still gives you some control on the L2 norm of f by its gradient. And the penalty, the price that you have to pay for that control, is this extra factor of log f. And of course, the Gaussian weight. And so this kind of thing gets used in statistical mechanics sometimes to control limits when something like the particle number goes to infinity, and so the dimension of the problem is growing. And this quantity well, so there are various different ways you can write this. So I guess you would say that this quantity here is called the Fisher information. It might be more customary to write it in terms of g equals f squared instead of f squared, and then I would have a g in the denominator over here, but never mind. So from this description, where I sort of said, well, the rate of decrease of slope controls the rate of decrease of relative entropy, controls the rate of decrease of horizontal distance, you might, and so far we only proved a rate of convergence here, or maybe using this HWI inequality here, you might want to get at this thing directly. And so I will close by showing you a short argument of, in this finite dimensional context, of once you have a rate of convergence in relative entropy, once you know that E of x minus E of x infinity goes to zero, there are some standard information theoretic inequalities for turning this into L1 rates of convergence. So this is called the Cesar-Kolak-Bach inequalities turn convergence in entropy sense, relative entropy sense, into L1 convergence. And I actually don't know very much about those inequalities. But I can point out schematically how you get at the rate of convergence in this sort of gradient norm, this Fisher information norm, which has somehow the gradients of f in it or the gradients of u in it. And for this, I sketched the Bakri-Emery strategy. So Bakri-Emery. Now, this doesn't give you a contraction rate. I sketch it again for the gradient flow I like, which is the finite dimensional version. X dot equals minus grad of V with Hessian of V of XT bigger than lambda, bigger than zero. And a strength of this Bakri-Emery method is that I actually only need to know this Hessian bound along the evolution. I don't need to know it for all X because I'm not going to use the mean value theorem anywhere.
And the idea is to is to give a direct rate of decrease for the slope of V for such an evolution, exponential. And I hope I have the right factor here. Maybe there's a 2. So I'm not sure where the 2 belongs there or not. Let's do the calculation and we'll see. So this time the proof is, instead of differentiating the distance between the two things, let's differentiate the gradient directly. And that gives me 2 gradient V of XT dotted with the derivative of this, which is Hessian of V of XT times X dot of T. And that's minus, X dot is minus the gradient of V, so that's minus 2 gradient of V Hessian of V gradient of V. But the Hessian of V is bigger than lambda, and so the minus sign always makes me confuse my inequality. So I guess this is less than or equal to minus 2 gradient V of XT squared, because I can replace V by lambda times the identity matrix. And that's minus 2 lambda G of T. And now Grunwald's inequality, this is a differential inequality, and Grunwald implies that G of T has to be less than e to the minus 2 lambda T G0. And so that gives you a rate of convergence in the strongest sense of the three, namely in the Fisher information sense, from which you can then derive relative entropy and Wasserstein distance. And that's a nice place to stop. So are there any questions? Okay, so thank you all for being my faithful audience. I guess Greg Loper is going to give a talk about, I think, C2 alpha estimates. So Caporelli's C2 alpha theory and Monge-Ampere context on Thursday. There are going to be student presentations in my class on next Tuesday. John will give his last talk a week from Thursday. And there are a couple of other talks in the Wednesday seminar that may be of interest. So I think Yongjung Kim is going to talk about fine asymptotics for porous medium equations a week from tomorrow. And sometime after Christmas Day, Ann Slepchev will give a talk in the Wednesday seminar on ideas, using ideas related to this to analyze a more complicated fourth order thin film equation. On January 14th. And I myself will be teaching a course in the spring on, which is going to be a combined graduate-undergraduate course on applied nonlinear equations, and so I'm planning to cover some bits of Evan's PDE book and some introduction to fluids, and that will depend on the audience somewhat what I actually do. So, okay.